Part 2. Noor. Don't worry if the Maranta dies, David says. It's been unhappy for a while.
Which one's the Maranta?
Noor asks. Dining room window, big leaves, brown at the edges. Right. There's a loud laugh from behind Noor. She turns round. A mistake. It's her other neighbours, and they catch her eye and wave, smiling. Irritated, she waves back. My biggest fear is that those two idiots will get it into their stoned heads to have children, she says to David. I thought they seemed sweet, David says. Noor supposes they are, in some ways. They walk out of their house arm in arm. They walk back up to it arm in arm, with their matching wool hats, sleepy eyes, wavy hair. Once the window was open and she heard the guy singing, a nonsense song about how beautiful the girl was. Then a sudden high giggle, like he'd just picked her up and spun her round. The glimpses of their closeness sometimes bother Noor more than the rubbish from their abandoned bin bags. On balance, she'd prefer to deal with a vole trapped in a crisp packet. David gives her a door key. I think that's everything, he says. I really appreciate this, Noor. I told you about the back door sticking.
You did, Noor says.
You didn't tell me when you'll actually get back from this residency or whatever it is. I'm not totally sure yet myself, David says. Sorry, I'll text you.
Okay,
just bear in mind that the longer I'm in charge of the plants, the less likely they are to survive. I really appreciate it, David says. You're a good friend.
Friend, thinks Noor. But she supposes, yes, that's what David is.
Not that she calls him that. If she ever talked about him, she'd say, my neighbour. It's the same with Louise. Louise is technically Noor's friend. But Louise is also her boss, and that's what Noor calls her. So really, she has two half-friends, adding up to one friendship in total. And she's happy with that number. She wouldn't want to have to water any more plants for a start. Louise and David actually used to know each other years ago. They shared a flat after university, when they were both grad students working at St. Helier's. When Noor made the connection and told them that she was their mutual half-friend, Louise and David reacted the same way. They both said what a small world it was, except David's eyebrows went up as he said it, and Louise's eyebrows drew down. Both of them were wrong, though, Noor thought. It's Crow's Hill that's the small world. With both Nepenthe and St. Helier's based nearby, it's the Silicon Valley of UK medical tech. On the cul-de-sac Noor and David live on, there's a cardiologist, an oncologist, a paediatrician, a Nepenthe technician, and a Nepenthe therapist. As David said once, it would be the best place in the world for something terrible to happen to you. Anyway, after the eyebrow activity, neither Louise nor David seemed that interested in the connection. It was a long time ago, was what David said. David's talking about something else now, some friends he plans to catch up with. Noor's lost the thread, but it doesn't matter. They're just making small talk while they wait for his taxi to appear at the bottom of the road. She tries not to look over David's shoulder for it. It's a mild day, grey, with sudden shots of sunlight across the roofs of the houses. Leaves have just started to fall, lining the sides of the road. How are you, Noor? David says suddenly. I know there's a lot going on at your work. From the grapevine, I mean. It's not like you tell me anything.
I'm okay.
What do you do in your spare time? In the evenings? Do you see people?
That depends on the evening.
Okay. What did you do yesterday evening? Saturday night?
I watched an old Star Trek on Netflix.
David sighs. You can just tell me to mind my own business, you know.
You don't believe me.
You've always said you hated sci-fi, which struck me as ironic, given your job.
I could tell you what happened in the episode.
Please do, says David.
It was about Captain Kirk falling in love with a robot called Raina. There was a love triangle with Kirk, Raina, and the guy who made her.
David's looking at Noor closely. He's frowning.
Why this story? He says.
I mean, why did you pick that episode?
Noor frowns back at him.
I don't know. Why do you ask?
Nothing.
Go on. What happened?
The two men fought over Raina, but then Raina died. It turned out all the new emotions she'd acquired were just too much for her. They blew her circuits or something. Kirk was very upset.
David's taxi turns into the road and makes its way towards them.
Here it is, Noor says with relief.
David's shaking his head, grinning.
I'm going to remember this morning, Noor. I've learned something new about you. A secret love of Star Trek. I'd never have guessed.
He looks so pleased that Noor doesn't have the heart to tell him that this is the first and only Star Trek episode she'll ever watch.
Well, enjoy it, she says.
I will,
he says. He's laughing as he gets into the taxi. Before he closes the door, he gives a Vulcan salute. If she'd known how easy it was to amuse him, she thinks, she'd have done it sooner. But who is she kidding? Of course she wouldn't. Almost as soon as she thinks it, she recognizes that this thought is essentially bullshit. Outside the clinic, Noor recognizes Imran, the security guard from yesterday. She waves at him, and he comes over to the car window.
How's it going, Dr. Ali? He says. Hope you weren't upset by yesterday.
Oh no, I'm fine.
The other guard, whose name Noor doesn't know, strolls over. This isn't exactly what Noor had in mind, but she smiles at him anyway.
Dr. Ali was the one that got spat on by that nutter, says Imran.
My car was spat on, Noor clarifies. And it's made a full recovery.
Effing maniacs, says the other guard.
I actually wanted to ask, who was he?
Noor asks.
The two men look at each other for a moment. Then the guard Noor doesn't know says,
No idea. We haven't seen him before. We told him to move along, and he did.
It's just that you seem to be after him already, Noor says to Imran. Before he spat on the car, I wondered if it was something about the placard he was holding.
Imran looks at the ground.
I didn't read it, Imran says to the ground. Sorry, Dr. Ali. He'd just been kicking off earlier. That was why we were after him.
Sounds like you've got your explanation, says the other guard cheerfully.
Noor is starting to dislike this man.
Yes, she says. So long as he's not going to be an ongoing nuisance, that's the important thing. Have a good day, both of you.
Noor makes a tea in the empty kitchen. She'd taken care to arrive early enough that this would be the case. She eats her apple while she waits for the kettle to boil. Then she takes the tea into her own office, opening the blinds onto the view of the grounds, or, more accurately, 57 very thin views of the grounds. The room fills with divided morning light. The first thing she does is log on to the computer and search the system for the word RASA. She doesn't really expect anything to come up, and nothing does. So she texts Louise and asks Louise to call her when she can. Noor has a couple of client interviews that morning. The first client is someone who saw a shooting at a pop concert and developed agoraphobia as a result. Now it's gone. She sits happily through Noor's checklist. At the end, she says she's glad to have had the procedure.
I feel like the world's been given back to me, the client says, because it was ruined before. It sounds dramatic, but I honestly couldn't see anything without seeing it. But now the world's back. In fact, it's better than it was before.
I'm going to... Well, I don't know. I'll just do something better with my life, I think. Be better. Something like that.
Good, says Noor. Better than before, writes Noor on the form. Unfortunately, the next client isn't quite as easy. She arrives and starts to cry. After about 5 minutes of crying, while Noor tries not to look at the clock, the woman finally says,
You deleted too much.
Excuse me? Noor says.
You deleted extra memories. On Monday, I forgot the name of the hotel I stayed in Greece last year. And then I couldn't remember what I needed to buy from the shop. And then, when I was thinking back, there were all these things I couldn't remember. Totally random things, like what year I got married and what my grandmother's maiden name was.
Noor tries not to sigh. Did you read your aftercare guide? She asks.
Yes, says the client. Well, most of it. It was so long. And then I Googled.
Don't Google, says Noor. Did you end up on a forum?
Yes.
Don't go on forums.
Oh, sorry.
Noor fixes the client with a stern look. Then she says, I hear what you're saying.
You do?
These sorts of fears are very common. But in fact, there's a safeguard built into the system itself that makes what you're describing impossible. The procedure uses a drug activated by a gentle electrical stimulation. Before the procedure even begins, we can see the areas of the brain that are to be activated and targeted. The second your attention moves away to the wrong areas, the current shuts off and the procedure stops. Once your attention has moved back and the correct areas of the brain are activated, we continue.
Okay, says the woman.
On Noor goes, reciting the aftercare guide. Except when she's finished, the woman still looks anxious.
Okay, thinks Noor. Let's have Phelps.
Want to hear how reliable memory actually is? Noor says. Says the woman.
Yes?
Not long after the Twin Towers were attacked, a scientist called Elizabeth Phelps surveyed several hundred people about their memories of that day. Then, a year later, they were surveyed again. The second time around, their memories were only 63% consistent with their original accounts. After another 2 years, this had dropped to around 50%. And these inconsistencies weren't just minor details. Some people even claimed to have been in a different place when the planes hit.
They were lying.
No, they genuinely believed in their latest version of events.
That's terrifying.
But the thing is, if there hadn't been a study, nobody would even have known they were wrong. Just like you're only noticing how unreliable your memory is because you're studying it now. Does that help?
I find that quite disturbing, actually, the woman says.
Okay. Well, there's good news. Noor remembers to smile here. The same people were surveyed again 10 years later, and this time their answers weren't much more inaccurate than the last lot, which shows at least there's a limit to how wrong we can be.
Right, says the woman.
She frowns, apparently falling into her own thoughts. All right, Noor says briskly. I feel that in this instance it would be helpful for you to discuss your thoughts and feelings with further therapy. I'm going to refer you to our team of dedicated memory specialists. They'll be here to support you in every way. At this, the client finally perks up. It's the dedicated team offering full support. This is what the anxious clients like to hear. But from what Noor can remember of her days as an interviewer, the anxious clients used to be more reassurable. It never took this long to get them out of her office. She rarely sent anyone to the therapy team. It's the restorations again, she thinks. The client's trust is wavering. And it's not surprising. Nepenthe promised people that their memories had been removed forever. Then it turned out to be wrong. Why? Because of science. Clients aren't very convinced by science at the moment, and they definitely aren't convinced by Nepenthe. Noor shows the woman out and sits down. She takes a sip of her tea. It's cold. At almost the same time that Noor, gazing out of the window, notices that Louise's Tesla is outside, parked in the spot usually occupied by the clinic director, Jim, a voice startles her. Dr. Ali? It's Marie, the receptionist, or at least her head, hovering hesitantly in the doorway. It's Dr. Nightingale, she says. She asked to see you when you have a spare minute. I suppose that means now, says Noor. Yeah, that's the impression I got, says Marie. A moment later, Louise is in Noor's office. She smiles and sits down. I didn't realize you'd be coming in today, Noor says. Well, I got your text and rushed right over, says Louise. Really? No, of course not. I'm here to go over some restoration stuff. What was the text about? It's going to sound weird, Noor says. But there was a protester yesterday who was causing a scene. Obvious mental illness. But I was curious about him. I felt like he might have had some connection to us. Have been a client, maybe. I was wondering if there was a way we could find out more about him. To do what? Louise says. If he's mentally ill, you know we can't help him. We can't do removals or restorations. She shakes her head. Don't worry. I'm sure our underfunded NHS will look after him. It's not just that, Noor said. It's that he was holding a placard. It said, Rasa cover-up. She waits. Louise looks back at her, blankly. After a long moment, Louise says, And? Don't you know what Rasa is? Noor asks, confused. Not a clue, Louise says. So, are you going to enlighten me? Noor opens her mouth. She hesitates. The problem is that she had genuinely expected Louise to say, Ah, yes, Rasa, not many people know about it, so keep this under your hat, but... And then explain who or what Rasa was. I just thought... I'd heard it somewhere round here before, Noor says. Really? Louise leans forward slightly. In what context? On your phone, Noor could say. I don't know, she says. I'm not even sure now where I heard it. I certainly don't know what it means. Okay, Louise says. She sits back. So, that's what you wanted to ask. That's why you texted. And for a second, Noor actually feels embarrassed. Before she reminds herself that she had every reason to text, that Louise, watching Noor with this slightly amused, slightly curious smile, has just told an out-and-out lie. That's how good Louise is. Yep, that's it, she says. I just felt bad for the guy. I know. It's a shitty system, says Louise. She says this with real feeling. Then she pushes her chair back. Listen, Noor, I need your co-authorization to access another client file. Would you mind? The co-authorization system is meant to protect client confidentiality. To look up a client's contact details, two senior doctors need to sign off on the action.
It applies even to someone at Louise's level. According to rumor, the system was implemented after a psychologist decided he was in love with a client and started stalking her, a story that never fails to make Noor squirm. Louise has had a few of these requests for Noor lately, post-fuck-up. The problem with the self-confidential patients, Louise explained, is that over the years some of them have changed their contact details and not registered their new email addresses with their GP practice. As a result, Nepenthe is having trouble getting the emails out to them. Louise has had to step in and get their home addresses. Noor is supposed to carry out a few basic checks on what Louise is doing, which clients she's looking up. She's definitely not supposed to type in her password and leave Louise to it, which is what she's always done up until now. But now, Louise has officially lied to her, and Noor's feeling somewhat unsettled. As a result, she hesitates before she says, "No problem," which was stupid. The hesitation is tiny, and the "no problem" emphatic, but she knows Louise will have noticed it. And yes, she glances up. Louise's head is on one side, and she's looking at Noor closely. Before Noor became one herself, psychologists were, in her mind, something akin to hypnotists or wizards. She used to believe that they could tell when someone was lying. Now, she knows they all do the same thing that Noor herself does, carry out basic checks. Not so much detectives of the mind as security guards, going round the perimeter, the same route, night after night. All done here, nothing unusual to report, let's call it a night. The exception to this is Louise, one of only two people in the world who has ever been able to tell when Noor is lying. So when Louise says, "You look troubled, what's wrong?" Noor knows there's no point saying nothing. "Just the clients," she says. "You know they don't believe anything we say anymore, all because of this restorations fuck-up." Louise brings her breath sharply in between her teeth. "Restorations," she says with some bitterness. "The public don't hate us because we played God. It's because we weren't God. We got something wrong. They've realized we're humans. They'll never forgive us." Louise has always been opposed to the restorations. She'd wanted Nepenthe to resist the public pressure. If they'd just held out for a terrorist attack or an earthquake, Louise said, it could have all blown over. "Could it bankrupt us?" Noor asks. "The cost of all the restorations?" "No," Louise says. "If Nepenthe'd had to compensate people, that would have been expensive. But it can't be held responsible for scientific advances. That was the ruling. We didn't know memories could be restored until the Glansman study with the snails. And don't say the word traces, or I'll literally have to sack you. Anyway, do you know the cost price of a single restoration? It's about £300. It's not an issue. The thing that will hurt us is bad publicity. Do you know that a man on YouTube who says Nepenthe was set up to wipe the memories of people who found out the earth is flat has 3 million subscribers? That the Twitter account Nepenthe Run by Aliens has 10 million followers? That's a lot of ill will, Noor says. Yes. And at some point, they're going to focus on something that's actually true. So that's when we're bankrupted. If people stop getting deletions, yes. And if I were you, I'd stop thinking in terms of we. There's no we, not in the company's eyes. There's you, and there's Nepenthe. And in fact, it would be no bad thing for the former to have some leverage regarding the latter. "Some what?" Noor asks. "Leverage. Dirt. Bodies. Location of. Are you following?" "Right," Noor says. She laughs, partly because she thinks Louise is probably joking, partly because she's worried that she's not. Louise looks at her for a minute, until Noor feels compelled to shift in her seat, crossing her legs, feeling less comfortable, uncrossing them. Then she smiles too. My next patient is here in 20 minutes, Noor says. I'll go and make another cup of tea, and you can do your thing. Is that long enough?
Plenty, says Louise.
Noor gets up, and Louise takes her place. Noor leans over Louise and types her password into the authentication screen. Louise averts her eyes comically high, out through the skylight. Looking for a signal from our alien overlords? Noor says, heading for the door. I'm glad you can see the humor, Louise says. Because we have to, don't we? And on that note, our beloved head of operations, Clifford Byrne, will be coming in with me in a couple of weeks for a walk around, which will be another thing for us to see the humor in, I hope. See you later. Noor's final appointment of the day is a client who chose to remove the memory of a rape rather than report it to the police. Noor, though she isn't really supposed to, asks the client why she decided not to press charges. But she already knows. The law against tampering with neural evidence means that crime victims and witnesses aren't allowed to delete the memory of a crime until a ruling has been made and any appeals are over. The client says that she didn't want to wait years before she was allowed to have the wipe. The man was untouchable anyway. She only wanted the memory gone. That was it. And now it's gone, and she's been feeling better. Okay. Noor says. Okay. She writes, has been feeling better. Tell me a story. Once upon a time, Captain James T. Kirk of the Starship Enterprise fell in love. But Raina, the woman he fell in love with, died. Or maybe it's more accurate to say that she suffered a systems failure. She broke down and couldn't be repaired. This loss left Captain Kirk incapacitated with grief. One night, he said to his first officer, Spock, "If only I could forget." Then he put his head on his arms and fell asleep. Spock decided that what would be best for Captain Kirk was if he, Spock, used a mind meld to erase the sleeping Kirk's memories of the woman he loved. So he did. And that was the end of that. The theme tune began. The credits rolled. And by the next episode, Kirk was his usual untroubled self and nobody ever mentioned Raina again, which you'd think might have happened by accident at least once or twice. So, do you think it worked? Noor asks Eleanor. Do you think Kirk really was his old self again? Eleanor doesn't answer. She stares out of the window, the light cutting its lines across her forehead, her cheek, her mouth, her neck. It's not very helpful. Actually, it's rude. But Noor guesses that's what you get, asking imaginary people questions. The real-life Eleanor was more forthcoming. For example, you have beautiful hair, Eleanor said. You should let it loose. It struck Noor how strange it was that she knew quite a lot about Eleanor, while Eleanor knew nothing about Noor. And yet it was Eleanor looking at Noor with something almost nostalgic in her friendliness, as if they'd known each other for a long time and had just been reunited. And this being the case, that it would seem natural for her to reach out and touch Noor's hair. Panic comes out oddly in a voice. In Noor's case, flat and affectless, like a recording warning commuters to move back from the train doors. It's difficult, she told Eleanor. We're not allowed to have any kind of, personal relationships with clients. The two of them were outside the Cat and Pigeon, where Noor, arriving, had walked straight into Eleanor coming from the other direction, her small face barely visible above her large fake fur coat. The night was black and sooty. Lights fizzled in the damp air. A fine sleet blew sideways. "Is that right?" Eleanor said. She was standing too close. Of course she was. It made Noor aware of their breath, commingling, communicating, or just shot down by the rain. "I could be fired just for coming here," Noor said. "And it's not a turning a blind eye kind of situation. They're very security conscious. I know they check up on us."
"So you came here just to tell me that?" Eleanor said.
"Yes."
"Quite a journey," said Eleanor.
"I mean it. It was very kind of you. In fact, I feel like I owe you a drink."
"You may as well have one, seeing as you're already here. Not in the bar. Don't worry. Somewhere totally anonymous. A top secret location. Screened for bugs and enemy agents. What do you say?"
Noor's attention returns to the office. It's time to go home. More than time to go home. If she doesn't hurry, the chemist will close, and she needs to pick up her sleeping pills. She ran out yesterday and had to spend the night listening to the sounds of her neighbours having a party. On a Wednesday. They'd turned the music down, probably after another neighbour complained, but people kept going outside to smoke, their voices rising straight up through the still air, as loud and emphatic as flying geese.
"Nina," the boy shouted from inside. "Nina, dance with me."
How old are they to be living together anyway, she wonders. Playing house, going to work after getting no sleep, in smart clothes that look, on them, like costumes. Don't they know the stats on the likelihood of it working out? Noor saw the girl sunbathing topless in the garden one Saturday. She turned away from her naked breasts, fiery white in the strong sunlight, a wince on her behalf. "Be careful," she wants to say to her. "Please look after yourself." Then that night, the two of them played drum and bass until 4 a.m. and she thought, "I hope your tit got burnt." But then, the day after that, she saw them in the garden, looking at a bird, a greenfinch, on the feeder, with their arms around each other's waists, heads tipped back, and she felt a moment of intense pain and longing. In short, the neighbours confuse and bother Noor, and she wishes they'd move out, or, as it's inevitable, just break up, get the hurt over with. She exits the clinic via a side gate and walks down the hill towards the high street. It's been raining while she was indoors, she didn't notice, and the air smells of wet tarmac and wet grass. The chemist is on the main square of the town, next to the handsome clock tower and opposite the large oak tree. A popular local claim is that the tree was once used as a gibbet to execute Cornishmen. Apparently, at the end of the 15th century, the Cornish rebelled against the king and marched on London. After they were defeated, some of the rebels fled to whatever Crow's Hill was called back then, where they were caught and hanged, three a day, until all 33 of them were dead. The story actually comes from the neighbouring town of Horsefield Heath, but that hasn't stopped the Crow's Hillians claiming that after the hangings, the sky above the town was black with crows for days, which is how the town got its name. They've also been known to claim that the Nepenthe Clinic is here because of the famous crow from the Edgar Allan Poe poem, which makes absolutely no sense at all. Locals, Noor thinks. She's waiting behind two of them right now, in the chemist queue. They're talking about the clinic. "It's a magnet for lunatics and criminals," one woman is saying. Noor has to give her that one.
"I know," says her friend.
The infant school is only a few yards down the road, the woman continues. All the parents having to walk past the protesters every day. It's only a matter of time before something terrible happens.
It's awful, says her friend.
It's already happened, thinks Noor dryly. And you're right, it is awful. It's only later that it occurs to her that true awfulness doesn't become apparent all at once. It arrives in bits and pieces, dribs and drabs. It drips, then it roars. It rains, and then it pours. But she didn't know that then. The first drip of awfulness comes at the end of September with the visit from Clifford Byrne. He arrives with Louise and a couple of other senior management people and is met by Jim Stokes, the clinic director. The five of them walk around, looking at the treatment rooms that have been repurposed for the restorations. Other than Crows Hill, the only clinics carrying out restorations are in Manchester and Scotland. This is because, as Clifford Byrne puts it, the restoration programme has been mobilised reactively with ambitious timescalings and streamlined resourcing. They've cobbled it together, is how Louise puts it. They don't have enough units. They don't have the staff. They have no fucking idea what they're doing. Noor stays in her office. After a while, the tour approaches her door. It's closed, but she can already hear the commanding voice of Clifford Byrne in the corridor outside. She imagines the voice rattling the slanted glass panels of the roof, startling the wood pigeons. By contrast, Jim Stokes's voice is hardly audible. He's a pleasant man who probably wishes he was in his own office, but isn't allowed to be because after working for the clinic for 20 years, he's attained enough importance to stand within commanding distance of Clifford Byrne. Noor stretches, comfortably, in her chair. She allows herself to feel smug about the way she has evaded real importance over the years. Louise has tried to put her forward for further promotion a few times, but Noor has got out of it, not with argument or active resistance, but by making herself very heavy and limp. The way you're supposed to if someone tries to drag you somewhere you don't want to go. Thanks, Jim, Clifford says. A dismissal. Louise's voice takes over from Jim's. It's a mellow sound, relaxing yet capable. It's clearly aimed at Clifford Byrne, and soon he laughs. As the party reaches Noor's door, she hears Louise saying, "All the research shows that a sense of personal identity, narrative continuity, goal motivation, and fulfillment can remain robust even in cases of severe episodic amnesia. The self might be a convenient fiction, but it's a remarkably resilient one." Someone says something inaudible in response, and then all the voices pass beyond hearing. Noor first encountered Clifford Byrne in 2008. Not that he'd remember meeting her. He was preoccupied at the time with propranolol, the drug everyone was hoping could cure PTSD sufferers without removing their memory, and what could be done to cast doubt over its efficacy and/or the reputations of the researchers. Noor said to Louise she'd rather, on balance, not have met Clifford. Why? Louise asked, giving Noor an "aren't you funny" look. I expected him to be more, not noble exactly, but him and the rest of the board, they're just like board members anywhere else. You should meet the scientists, Louise said. They're even worse. I met the guy who basically invented the procedure and he ate with his mouth open. Also, he smelled. But they're more principled, surely, Noor said. The scientists. Louise's "aren't you funny" look deepened, took on other elements. Noor thought she could make out "how sweet." Or maybe it was "wake up, idiot."
Then it was nothing at all, except Louise's warm, sincere smile.
Sure, said Louise.
How much does Eleanor remember? Noor wonders. Does she remember throwing herself back on her pillow, saying, Hey, you want some wine? I did promise you a drink. Do you prefer red or white or spirits? Hang on, do you drink?
Why do you ask? Noor said. Because I'm Arabic.
What? No. Good Lord, are you always so defensive?
Sorry.
Some of us white people don't drink either, you know, Eleanor said. My mum didn't. That's partly why we never got along.
Family, right?
Do you get on with yours?
What?
Your family, you know, mum and dad, ma and pa.
Ah, no, Noor said. I don't see them.
There was a silence, and then Eleanor said, thoughtfully, You don't like talking, do you, Noor?
Not this sort of talking. I'm not great at it.
But you talk for a living.
That's different, Noor said.
I'm not personally involved. I prefer it that way. An observer of people rather than a participant. Eleanor gave her a sly smile. She had very white teeth. Noor had noticed that the inside of her mouth was very pink, a vivid, bright mouth, always ready to drink, lick, taste, bite, and talk.
You seemed to be participating just now, Eleanor said.
Well, I've never done this before.
You've never?
Shit. What, you're a...
Noor nodded. There was a long silence.
Wow, Eleanor said at last. She'd raised herself up to peer straight into Noor's face, which Noor tried not to mind, and now she laughed and collapsed back onto the bed again. Her hair rolled over the pillow, the tips of it touching the tips of Noor's own unloosed hair.
Why didn't you say something? Eleanor asked.
Why? What would you have done differently? Said Noor.
I don't know.
Lit candles? Eleanor said.
Well, I've got to say I do feel pretty smug about that.
Have you not been tempted before?
What's the closest you came, I mean, to this?
Not very. And not very.
Okay, sorry. Shit, you weren't playing around. You really don't like questions.
It's fine. We don't have to do that.
There's other stuff we can do.
Oh?
Things are looking up, said Noor.
Let's tell stories.
Stories.
Don't look like that. I don't mean personal stories. In fact, the rule is that they aren't allowed to be personal in any way at all. I'm with you on that, believe it or not.
You never tell your stories.
Well, I've told mine too often. I'm sick of them. I only told you because I wanted you to hear everything about me up front, see whether you'd still come here.
That's why?
I thought you were slightly unhinged, Noor said.
Is that a professional diagnosis?
Well, maybe I am a bit unhinged, but you're still here.
So, tell me a story.
I think you've gravely misunderstood how creative I am, said Noor. I can't just make up a story.
Tell me a story made up by someone else then, said Eleanor.
Oh, and the other rule is, it has to have a happy ending.
Noor thought for a while.
Okay, she said, I have one. Orlando Paladino. An early example of someone actually benefiting from the removal of their memory.
Who?
Is this one of your patients? That's cheating.
It's an opera by Haydn.
Orlando Paladino is a knight.
In fact, he's a maniac who spends most of the opera stalking and harassing a princess named Angelica. Angelica doesn't love him, but Orlando doesn't care. He's obsessed. He tries to kill any other man she so much as glances at. In the end, Angelica's saved by a sorceress named Alcina.
I like that, said Eleanor.
Alcina takes Orlando to the river Lethe. That's where souls who are crossing over to the lands of the dead drink to forget their lives on earth. The boatman dips Orlando into the water, and Orlando forgets all about Angelica. His love vanishes. His rage vanishes. He's cured. He goes back to his previous existence. Angelica can get on with her life, and everyone's happy.
Interesting, said Eleanor. But okay, I have questions.
Like?
What else is gone? What's left?
What would have happened to him if the boatman had dropped him and he'd been in the water for hours before they fished him out?
No idea, Noor said. You wanted a happy ending. You didn't say you wanted answers.
Eleanor threw herself down on the pillow again and laughed. Once Clifford Byrne and the others have gone, Louise comes to Noor's office. She seems to be in a good mood.
It went well then? Noor asks.
What? The walk around? No, it was a shambles, but it's over now.
Anyway, before I go, would you mind signing me off on a client file? Another of the elusive self-confidentials.
Sure, Noah says. No hesitation.
I was about to make a tea anyway. Want one?
She gets up. Louise moves into her chair.
Would I?
Louise is already clicking on files.
Oh, tea. No, thank you.
Noah, leaning over Louise to enter her name and password, notices that Louise still wears the same perfume. The scent of it takes Noor back to that first interview with Nepenthe, when she was so impressed with the company and Louise's expensive-smelling perfume and the sci-fi technology literally saving lives, and Louise's referring casually to the architect working on her modernist Japanese-influenced house, and her way of smiling when Noor answered a question right, as if she were willing Noor on, saying, come on, you can do it. You too can wear expensive perfume and administer life-saving sci-fi technology and live in a modernist house and know when and how to smile. The kitchen is empty when Noor arrives. There are no windows to look out of, so she watches the temperature gauge on the kettle and feels... what? By the time Noor gets back to her office, Louise has finished what she was doing and is just closing Noor's door behind her. She's got her bag and coat. Her good mood has apparently vanished. Her expression hasn't changed, but all the bones of her face look locked.
That was quick, Noor says.
Actually, I didn't manage to get everything done, Louise says. A bit of a pain, really. I've got to leave now. I've got a meeting. I'll try to get back in next week or something.
No problem, Noor says.
See you soon.
Noor logs back into her computer, sitting in the warm chair, which, shaped to Louise, feels momentarily unfamiliar. When she picks up her phone to call reception, even the phone feels unfamiliar. Then she realizes that this is because the phone smells, quite unmistakably, of perfume. Noor brings the handset to her nose. She sniffs. Words like benzoin, ambergris, oud come to mind. Gold-lidded, square-cut bottles displayed on shelves in the marble bathrooms of modernist glass-walled houses. Louise. She must have been calling reception, or Jim. Noor thinks, as she presses the last dialed button. She isn't sure why she does this.
or why it doesn't surprise her when the phone doesn't connect to reception or gym, but trumpets a sharp tone in her ear and informs her that this number is out of service. Noor puts the handset down. Now, Noor thinks. There's nothing technically wrong here. Louise must have called a private number. Louise has every right to use Noor's phone to make personal calls if she wants to. More right, in fact, than Louise has to delve alone into client records, which she was also doing. Sitting at the desk, looking up client records, making calls. Huh, thinks Noor. She tries to imagine why Louise, being the owner of a perfectly good phone, a phone Noor has seen her using already today, might decide to use Noor's phone instead of her own. Does Louise remember Noor's previous career? Is what Noor wonders then. Noor had gone into her first interview planning to talk about her background in software development and cybersecurity as little as possible. She didn't see much difference between coding and psychology, but she was aware that other people did, and that dropping one to retrain in the other could have cast doubt on her personal consistency, her character itself. In the end, Louise made it clear she didn't believe in either concept, which was lucky, because Noor had spent most of the interview going on about coding. So probably Louise does remember, but just hasn't realized how easy it would be for Noor to do what she is now doing, which is to log in to the system as an executive administrator and retrace Louise's own steps. Or, more probably, Louise knows all of this, but would never have suspected that Noor would check up on her. Noor herself isn't 100% sure why she's checking up on Louise. Something to do with expensive perfume, maybe. The way Louise said, "Anyway, before I go." Louise only looked at two pages, it seems. The first thing she did was exactly what she said she was doing. She looked up a client's contact details. The problem is, while Noor can see the type of page that was accessed, even in admin mode, she can't see who this person is. Not without getting a co-authorization herself, which would draw attention to her activities, or hacking into the page, which would draw more. Noor's good, but she's not better than Nepenthe's cybersecurity team. They'd know there'd been an internal breach immediately. The second page Louise viewed is from the clinic's calendar. This isn't sensitive data. Noor could have accessed it just by pressing the back button. Louise was apparently looking at the first week of November, a schedule of all the appointments at the Crows Hill Clinic. Four people are coming in that week, presumably to get restorations, as no new procedures are being carried out. Noor supposes that one of these must be the person Louise was trying to call, as she's clicked through straight from a client page. Again, she has no way of knowing which person Louise is looking for. She makes a note of the four names anyway. None of them mean anything to her. "Okay," Noor says out loud, as if Louise herself is in the room. Which might be why Noor's okay sounds not resolute, "Okay, Louise, you asked for it," but almost pleading. "Louise, is this okay?" In the absence of a response from Louise, Noor looks up the last quarter's CDR report for her own phone. It's not difficult to find the numbers Louise called. Noor herself tends to use her mobile. There are 11 unfamiliar numbers on the list, all of them made during, Noor checks her diary, Louise's last visits. Huh, she thinks again. There's not much Noor can really do with a list of numbers, most of them mobiles.
She goes back to the page log and scrolls back to the dates Louise visited. As she expected, each time Noor co-authenticated Louise's activity, Louise went straight to a client's contact details page. So she was calling clients. But why would she do that? Noor can see, too, that on several occasions, Louise also looked up clinic schedules and, most importantly, client case notes. She looked up the case notes for 8 out of the 11 people she called. These are pages Noor, as a senior psychologist, can access and does. It seems that the clients Louise looked up are all self-confidentials, which might have been the only thing she was honest about. Case note pages for self-confidentials don't actually contain much information because Nepenthe isn't allowed to keep a record of the deleted memory. In fact, the only person in the entire world who ends up knowing what the memory was is the psychologist who deals with that client. The treatment doctors strolling around the Nepenthe corridors are living libraries of exiled memories. In addition, all the people Louise looked up were once her own clients, presumably from the long-ago days when she had clients. Not so strange, necessarily. The strangest thing, the worst thing, the thing that Noor can't make sense of, is the status report for each client. Louise had told Noor that she was trying to track down self-confidential clients who had moved house or dropped off the map or whatever. But Noor can see that nobody has, in fact, moved house or dropped off the map, and that all these people, every single one of them, have already been tracked down. Every one of these people had responded to the email from Nepenthe, most of them weeks ago, to say they'd like to take up the offer of a memory restoration. But then, every one of them, within days or even hours of being called by Louise, got in touch with Nepenthe and said they didn't want a restoration after all. Which means Louise's calls to these people weren't on the record. They weren't authorized. They weren't legal. And whatever Louise said to these people definitely wasn't legal. Louise could get sacked for this. Noor could get sacked for co-authorizing it. Fuck, Noor mutters under her breath. She's cold with fright. Fuck, fuck, Louise, what the fuck? None of the clients gave a reason why they wanted to cancel their procedure. Change of mind was the box that was ticked. Ha, ha, thinks Noor. Literally a change of mind. No changing back. Ha, very not very ha.